Welcome to the B-Side. It's Tyler with you, as always, with Pastor Steve, and we have a special guest. Say hello, special guest.
Hello, special guest.
Oh, I'm so lame.
Yeah, so is your intro.
In case you haven't figured out by the lameness of that comment, our dear friend Rhoda is joining us. We roped her into sitting in with us today, and we're glad to have her.
I'm coming to check up on you, taking over this hosting bit. I don't know, you could have done a better intro, maybe.
Well, we did have our two biggest hits the last 2 weeks on B-Side Listens. And I got told by one of our listeners how funny I am on the B-Side, so...
Now you're going to get a write-in about it.
Doesn't count, Tyler.
Right. Yeah. Well, meow, I just think that...
Did you just say meow?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. We had a busy week for all of us in the office today. It's Monday. I don't know when you're listening to this, but for us in the office Monday, it was a bit of a like, woo! Because the AGM has passed. There was a lot of build-up and hard work that kind of got us to that point. All three of us were at the AGM. Steve obviously kind of led us through it. Rhoda was a participant. I was a participant.
I was there.
We were there as members and as ministry leaders in some capacities. So, Ro, what was your highlight coming out of the AGM?
The dessert was really good.
Yeah, the dessert was good. A lot of people missed it, which could be a good set. We had some noticeable absences, I think. But we had a great group that
beautiful
was there.
Sunny
yeah,
night.
Beautiful sunny day. But lots of cool things came through. We got to hear about what stood out.
You know what I really appreciated was, I mean, I've been at this church a long time without aging dating myself here.
She's 40.
I'm not yet.
Well, may as well be.
Okay. So, anyway.
She looks 40. Sorry.
Okay. So, you can write into Tyler about that if you want. So, anyway, what I appreciated was, I mean, we've done the annual general report. Very functional, perfectly great booklet. The booklet I'm talking about, where we actually you guys put out the written report. We've done it the same way for many, many years. But I really loved the feel this year, Steve. I thought you did a great job on it, and I know it's a lot of work, so I appreciate you taking the initiative on it. But it just had that which you were going for, a more cohesive feel. It didn't feel like a whole bunch of silos of people all belonging to the same group and then having all their own little clubs or their own little services that minister to them. And not that that was ever what it was in reality, but I felt the format. Yeah, I felt like this one, it just felt like, what are we all about and how are all the ways that they're coming through? And then even having photos of people and connecting it to real change lives or real community living together, I thought it felt like, okay, this is going to make it sound trite, and I don't mean it that way, but it almost felt like a school annual, like a year annual of, like, you're all excited for your yearbook to come out in high school, like, what happened that year, and who was there, but it even felt, like, less clubby than that. Mm-hmm. It just felt it was encouraging, and it didn't feel so sectioned and...
Did you get your year in review signed by your friends after?
Yeah, I should have. I should have people signed by their
friends. All I wrote in Rhoda's was, have a great summer. See you, Tyler.
Anyway, I thought it was good.
No,
I really appreciate it.
And I would
it.
Add to that as a kind of paid employee who's often,
paid?
Yeah,
you
a little bit.
Just
a little bit. But I'm generously paid. It's great. Anyway, I'm not complaining, please. I'm like, now look what you did, Rhoda. No, my point was going to say, Paul Pablo and I were talking about this, that it felt nice for us because sometimes it feels like that there's a temptation as a pastor on a staff to validate your purpose, your role. So you're often not going to be maybe as honest as you would be about maybe some of the struggles or changes or challenges. You might not mention things that might make you look bad or your job, like you're not doing it. And flip side, you're going to highlight all the things that make you look good quite naturally. Thing I appreciated about that is that, Steve, who I'm accountable to, kind of accepted the kind of review that I put together, but kind of backed it for us. That he got to celebrate, he got to kind of decide as a church and elders, here are things about the ministry and the work that Paul's doing and Tyler's doing and other ministry leaders are doing. That we want to highlight.
But it all fit together.
Yeah.
Yeah, was like, this is part of what we're about, and you were one of the ways that was happening.
Yeah, and I think, for me, one of the other highlights I just mentioned before we move on was This idea of the 50-50 trying to celebrate our 50th anniversary. We're going to celebrate our 50th anniversary through kind of an outward kind of project and an inward, in a sense, like a home front project and a
mission here, mission there.
I love the marrying of those two things together. It's great.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting, I think, season for us to move into. Any highlights for you, Steve? I mean, you put it all together and. You're a lot of stress left in your body.
There's a lot of work, a lot of stress. It's good to get through. It's just for those listening, it's just a lot of work, and I think we build up to it and want it to go well as far as getting finances together, getting all that stuff together. But so it's kind of nice to get it done. But I think one of the highlights wasn't so much the night, but the work in advance of, which was like looking through those photos. Sometimes you forget all the things that happened. And in the traditional way that we've done reports, where we're kind of listing activities, but it's not a list of activities that really change people. There's moments, not so much. I could list. I preach this many sermons, but it's not the thing that really stands out in the course of a year is moments. So I love the picture of Micah's dedication. With Ian and Shirley on stage, and because that wasn't, it was in some ways, I viewed it as the culmination as a church in a moment captured, but it was a long history of praying for Micah before we knew he was Micah, and and there he was, and we have this photo of that moment, and child dedications, we didn't even mention it. There was children dedicated, children born. Those aren't something that often make reports. And yet that was a really special moment for our church or the picture of like the 25 students that graduated. Lined up on the stage, filling the whole stage.
It's not like one
baptisms and
the pictures that made it in there were the special ones and the ones that didn't weren't. They're representatives, right?
I loved the picture of Doreen. You and Doreen. I don't think I ever actually got to meet her.
Oh, I feel so sad.
She just like that picture immediately. I was saying to Melissa, immediately drew me back to that Sunday and how warm and sweet and just like generous of spirit she came across in her leaving and the way that we got a chance to honor and pray for her and send her off well. But that picture, just the way she kind of cozied up to you, it's just like, it's just a sweet little image of the year in a nutshell.
So it reminds, I think it brings back to mind all those special moments that you kind of can forget happened or.
Yeah.
So,
One, I think reflection is a good exercise for all of us in the church to both be reminded and to look just reestablish why we do what we do. And one of the things we did a couple of weeks ago on the B side was we had a seven things not to say to your pastor before he preaches. We reviewed a blog and got a lot of feedback on it that it was good. And Rhoda just informed us that she thought it was something that we birthed out of somebody had said something negative to Steve at one point. And we were coming with an axe to grind, but
I was scared to listen. I was like, what happened?
Although I had a moment on Sunday from someone who clearly does not listen to the B-side, who with not great motive wanted to pick a fight with me.
Oh, great.
At 9:58. And it was really distracting, and I had to pray and like calm down before I preached.
Here's the link. I'll email it to you.
It's not the time to argue with me.
But one of the other ones, so we spent a lot of time in our AGM talking about mission, and part of this 50th anniversary celebration is about wanting to see newcomers come into our church and welcomed. And so we talked about wanting to focus on the mission field of our building and doing some work there to kind of use it well. But it got me thinking about how we welcome first-timers. And same guy, Tom Rayner, who did the last blog of him, had another blog that I found. The top 10 ways...
He's your special guest.
He's like almost like a specialist, but he does these good numbered blogs where you kind of go, here are a few things that you can go through and check out. But he did a Twitter poll. It was how he did this blog. The top 10 ways to drive away first-time guests. And he says, I did a Twitter poll to ask first-time guests why they chose not to return to a particular church. So it was just kind of like a non-scientific kind of evaluation. It got respondent. Now, some people I'm sure had an axe to grind. Some people probably were just honest. And he says some were anticipated. There were a few that surprised them. And so it's not scientific. He lists his top 10. And I'll read them right meow. Number one, having...
Right in today, yeah. After this B-side, if you can name how many times...
I meow?
You snuck a meow in.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting pretty
we
good
We should
at
get
it.
A, like, a
meow.
Giveaway.
We're going to get back to this. So it says... The first one is one that we do. And it's kind of buzzing around in our in kind of like the Twittersphere. I've heard people talk about it. And I disagree that it's a poor thing. I think it can be if it's done poorly. I can understand it.
Why don't you tell us what it is?
It's having a stand up and greet one another time in the worship service.
Uh-oh.
And saying that this response was the greatest surprise, he said, for two reasons. First, he was surprised at how much guests were really uncomfortable during this time. And then it was the most frequent response. Now,
really?
Yeah. Huh. Which is interesting to think because a lot of churches do. It's pretty common practice. And I think for us in our church... I enjoy it. I'm also an extrovert. I'm also somebody who likes to kind of be with people. But you were saying that that's something that you believe in, and you would classify yourself as...
I'm not like a hill to die on. I think I introduced it. I don't think we did it.
Well, we... You know what?
It's
I've been
come
here
and
for
gone.
A long time. It's come and gone.
Yeah, but I think when we restructured our service order 5 years ago, and at that time I think I reintroduced it. I mean, your motive, the reason why it's surprising is because it's going exactly against its purpose, right? Like, the purpose is to welcome guests. We don't greet each other because, you know, we should just say hi to each other, like, in this sort of superficial way.
That's funny, because if you always sit in the same section,
you end up saying and you've often said hi to those people already. Yeah. It's true. I mean, I could get rid of it if we decided that it...
Right into the B side and tell us what you
think. Well, I like the purpose of it in that if it's done purposefully, like one of the things I try to do that is like I don't try to go out of my way to greet Rhoda during that time.
No. I've noticed.
I know, yeah. Yeah, I just lay eyes on her.
Nobody does.
Yeah, no. Rhoda's the one who kept tweeting this guy about this one.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't, nobody comes to greet her. But no, it's I'm scanning.
Yeah.
I'm going, okay,
is there
anybody new?
Imagine if you said, hey, greet someone new today, and then, like, 20 people all go to the same person.
Yeah. No, I think it should be, like, there's language that's used for members, and there's, like, in the sense of going, like, we shouldn't have to tell people. If you see someone you don't know,
say hello.
Yeah. Introduce themselves. That's just part of being a warm...
Is pretty good at
and
that.
I think our church is generally pretty good at it. I'm sure it makes some people uncomfortable, but I think often the people that are uncomfortable by that are the people that want to be, they don't want their visit recorded. In the sense just want to come, observe, and leave.
And I'm okay with that. Like,
You're
I think
okay with what part of that?
Practices which expose guests and draw them into commitments they're not ready for,
right.
We should not do. I think it's so totally fine if somebody wants to come to a church for the first
time. All the newcomers, stand up. Would you wave? Give
I think
us
that's
a wave.
Awful.
Yeah. No, especially when you're single. See, that's another difference. Are you singling them out, or is everybody doing
anything
it?
That singles them out? I think because what you want is for guests to be able to come in and just observe for a couple weeks and just see, is this the church that's right for me? And not be forced into something they're not comfortable with. And then when they're ready, they know what the next steps are, and it's in their ballpark. Like, we're not hunting them down. We're being friendly. But when they want to learn more, they know where to go. When they want to find out about community groups, it's obvious what they should do. The next steps are obvious, and they can take them when they're ready. And that's kind of been the philosophy we've had. We provide all the information. We know, like... We introduce ourselves every service. You know, say, I'm Tyler. Yeah. I'm Steve.
I hope you don't say I'm Tyler.
No, I generally don't.
Yeah.
We say, here's where you can get more information.
Yeah.
A lot of our communication, a lot of our announcements are geared towards people so they know what the next steps are.
Yeah.
But then we don't force them to take those next. We wait till they're ready. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting.
For a while.
The next
well, that's the thing is, what's the difference between that and someone who's been doing that stance for six months to a year?
So I'm talking about a few weeks where people are trying to... On their first Sunday, you don't want to force them into a commitment.
Yeah. In reality, like, and we, like, and just, people like you and I who are on the platform a lot know, just as a fact, chances are a newcomer is going to know, there's just a good chance, they're going to know a lot more about us, and they're probably going to feel like they know us a little bit, before we even know who they are.
Yeah.
Generally, just because if they've done that observation,
or they might hear an illustration. How did they get to our church?
Or they might come onto the website and read a bio about us. Yeah. And so they come and it kind of gives them.
So what's the rest of your list?
Okay, yeah, I was trying to get there, but Ro jumped in front of the train there. Unfriendly church members. This one goes without saying. I think like most of us know that can turn people off. In the newcomers especially. And I think this is one that we always have to evaluate as a church. I think, like, because we like to think of ourselves as a friendly church. It's the one thing, like, every church, if you go to their website, you might find
something friendly.
Or a friendly group of people.
Not always.
No, it's not always been the experience. And so I think it's because sometimes we feel comfortable, because we're like a family, sometimes to be a bit more nasty with one another or gruff, and we don't have eye to the newcomer. Unsafe, unclean children's area.
Oh, for sure.
Of course, that's going to turn, like, if you're a parent and you have small children and you go to church.
Probably a deal breaker.
Yeah. You know what?
When we first really started putting in Plan to Protect into effect, it was a little annoying for people who've been here for years. I get it. I've been here a long time. I've worked in children's ministry a long time. And so all of a sudden you're like, seriously, I'm good with this. Why can't I just leave my kids stuff? But I have one of my best friends from growing up, non-Christian, and I got to see it through her eyes, and when a guest comes and they don't know you and they don't have the comfort and facility, the fact that we have clean facilities, the fact that we have Plan to Protect in place and what that is makes all the difference to them.
Oh yeah, I remember my brother in my last church, just like we didn't do it then, and saying like his kid came and like all of a sudden during the service they're like, all right kids, you can have Sunday school, and he's like, somebody came and like took my kid and like they've just gone, and he's like, I didn't care because my brother's pastor on the staff. He's like, I get it. But he was like, if I was a stranger, that would be super weird. And then, like, I don't know where to go to get them after the service. Like, it was just, so that's helpful. But it goes without saying that it can be hard.
Okay, but those are givens.
Yeah, no place to get information. I think that's a good one. Like, where, like, we try to send people to the info center, which is hopefully they see that.
It's painted large on
the
walls.
That can be really disconcerting when you walk into a building and you go, like, I remember walking into a church and just going, like, looking for, like, can I find a statement of faith or anything like that about what you believe? And they're like,
well, and sometimes you're scared to ask somebody because then you feel like all of a sudden they're going to jump all over that and you want to become a member and you just walked in or something.
Yeah.
You just want to get information.
Yeah. No, or sort of bad church website. This one.
Yeah.
I mean, we all understand just generationally. Goes without saying, it's like the front door.
It is. It's
makes
your window.
Sense. People, it's just like most people, almost everybody who's going to go to a church are going to check it out online first. Poor signage. I'm assuming
in the building,
this. Yeah, I'm assuming this means in the building, like where the kids area is, where the restrooms are, where the sanctuary is. Insider church language. Like, everyone come to the WMP at the CRG held in the WHL. and people are like, huh? And I think you always have to check yourself because there is just that colloquialism that goes through. All right, keep moving. I got three more. Boring or bad service.
I thought you were going to say sermon and you changed that word at the last minute, didn't you?
It says service, I promise.
Oh, okay.
but you could throw sermon in there. Like, I'm not going to go to a church with a terrible preacher because I think preaching is important. Mediocre, maybe. They pay me.
Yeah, but I'd rather have a bad preacher with gospel than a charismatic preacher with no gospel.
Absolutely, clearly.
If you're picky.
This one happened in a church I know. Members telling their guests that they were in their seat.
What?
Yes. Like this was like there was a I know of a church that like they extended the like parents with children seating in the back. And they put signs in the end, and the guy would come every Sunday because that was his pew, and he would take it.
Go sit in
he would
your
take
own
his pew.
Pew,
and he would take the sign right off. And then last one, dirty facility. Like that, like, you put your best foot forward. Interesting stuff. So what do you think, if there was one thing on that list that you go, as a church, we could probably do better, what do you guys see it being? Greeting time, unfriendliness, Unsafe or unclean kids area, no place to get information, bad church website, poor signage. I actually think we're pretty solid on a lot of these sites. Insider language.
A lot of those things we've worked
boring
on.
Boring service.
So,
well, I think we're actually conscious about working on them. Like, I don't think.
Yeah, I think none of these are
glaring. Intentional.
I would say if there's one that we probably have to constantly check, it'd be insider language. Do we use insider language?
Because it's...
Because you, it's, one, you jump into a
bio. One other was, and we've done a lot of work on this, is, what was it about the facility?
Dirty facility, signage? Proper signage, improper signage.
So some of those things, like the first impression, you think about our foyer before we updated it and our bathrooms we updated them and how ugly they were. This is your first impression. People walk in, first time, is
well,
this somewhere?
Well, and we don't think, like, we think it's just for us and it doesn't matter, but I once had a newspaper was doing an article on something we were doing and they came to take pictures and he literally, like, we were in the lobby and he was shooting from up on the staircase down.
Oh.
And we had that old carpet in there.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to have to Photoshop this up. And he's like, this carpet is so bad. And I was so embarrassed because it's like, it felt like this is my house and this is someone else like going, ooh, that is like the ugliest carpet I've ever seen, which could be construed as rude on his part. But I'm like, but we are like, look at who we are supposed to be, right?
Yeah. I love, and that was one of the things that you said at the AGM actually that I was like, that was, I found it really helpful just in thinking through how as a church we spend our resources, going like, thinking through like upgrades or building improvements, not as being spent on ourselves, but as actually being missional. Because if this is where we're preaching the Bible, this is where I'm inviting our friends, that we want our facility to serve us well for that purpose.
Does it create a bad first impression when someone's open to the church and the gospel and their first impression is
Yeah.
Well, gross. I think there's also a difference. Like, if you never keep things up, then it almost looks like everything's antiquated, right?
Yeah.
Like,
is your message as antiquated as your building?
Right. But I also think there's a difference between that and these multi-million-dollar facilities. Sure. Like, there's still
that sends a message too.
Right. Right. Like, where's the balance of having spending responsibly and maintaining things well?
I draw the line at water features.
Do you?
Yeah, everything up to
the
water.
Will take. Come on, you're stuck with my version, man.
So, like, I
was interested. That was a pretty good one, eh?
Because we were talking about seating and carpet in the sanctuary. Because you know our pews are they're original, and
there's
carpet
one that
is original.
So bad.
Yeah, and so some.
Let me just be honest, as a newcomer, they're not attractive.
Yeah, so
they're a color that is not modern, but we get used to them.
We've thought about
I'm not attractive, but you get used to me.
We've thought about, you know, eventually at some point we're gonna have to update things. Yeah, we've been toying with it, thinking about it. But I remember something that someone said to me just a few weeks ago. It really stood out. Someone said about inviting their non-Christian friends, and this person said, "I'm not embarrassed about the gospel, but I am embarrassed about our building." So this person wants to bring their friends, invites their friends. Sometimes their friends come to church with her, but she's not ashamed. She's not ashamed at all of our service, of the preaching of the gospel, of the people, but is sort of wincing at some of the things in our some of the aesthetics, right? And that really stood out to me. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So anyway,
it was good stuff. It was I like these kind of lists because I think it's just a neat little checklist and gets us thinking about stuff. Now, Ro, when we were chatting about this and talking about the service on Sunday, you had a question kind of about the difference between vengeance and justice.
Well, like, yeah, I thought
it was fair to hit Steve with that.
Well, yeah, like I thought it was a great sermon on Sunday. What I'm loving about Ezekiel is it's like the scriptures coming to life for me. Like I'm imagining it kind of in realistic.
It's like you're drawing it and talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, like that person who drew it at the beginning of the service. But but one of the things I wondered is you were talking about vengeance.
That's the line that always stands out to me. Sorry, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Hopefully someone listening has watched the intro video to understand the context. So
if you haven't, join us on a Sunday morning.
Anyhow, one of the things was you were talking about vengeance and how vengeance is not ours to take, that is the Lord's job. And that got me thinking, because sometimes things happen and we want to seek vengeance, but sometimes things feel justified. Like things happen in life, whether it's even not, let's say, let's take it a nobler step. It's not even something that's happened to us. It's happened to someone we care about or someone who's vulnerable, and it makes us angry and our our anger feels justified. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't want to sit there and do nothing.
Yeah.
But then you say, but vengeance isn't yours to take. You have to leave all that to the Lord. And my question was, when is the line between seeking vengeance and seeking justice, mm-hmm. which the word does call us to be people who seek justice. Mm-hmm. So how do we know when we're doing one and when we're doing the other? Because yeah. you don't want to check out altogether from, like, it talks about taking up the cause of the widow and the poor and the orphan. Mm-hmm. And so,
I think that's a good question. I think the best place to go is Romans 12 and 13. There's two aspects of it that are actually right beside each other. In Romans 12, verse 16 to 21, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be conceited. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And to the contrary, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. So, when wronged, I think the proper response out of the gospel is to show kindness. And this is the radical teaching of Jesus, turning the other cheek and these types of things. So, showing kindness, living peaceably, not seeking vengeance, and we don't seek vengeance because we are able to leave that with God. And if God is completely sovereign and just, we don't have to be the ones that personally take that step of justice and vengeance. We can trust that God will right the wrongs. So on the one side, we say, treat your enemy with respect, grace, love, kindness, be peaceable. And this is like so radically countercultural. Now, then the next thing, beginning of chapter 13, is it talks about the role of the authorities, and it's relevant to this. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God, talking about governments and things of that nature. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. And he kind of goes on and talks about taxes and things like that. So God is in authority of all things. He has put rulers in authority to serve him and his purposes, including, it talks about them bearing the sword. So the government has authority and has responsibility to reward the good and punish the wrong. And when they do that, they are acting on God's behalf.
So what happens when you have corrupt authority? Like in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge that went in.
So
they were punishing good, not punishing bad.
I think this does not mean that we submit to the government as insofar as we're able to while submitting to God. Right? So, but if there's a conflict where to submit to the government would mean violating a moral command of God, government tells you, kill that person. You don't do it. You don't obey the government when it demands you disobey God. We must obey God rather than man, in the words of the apostles in the beginning of Acts.
But so, that's still different than taking up a sword yourself and attacking the other side.
I think the government, there is a place for justice and, you know, things like prison and penalties and dealing with crime. And the government has a morally obligated role from God to do those things. We have government. But our natural tendency is not going to be justice. Mm-hmm. If you're wrong, your natural tendency is going to be escalating revenge.
And
we're called to not seek vengeance, but instead trust that God will do that. And one of the ways he does it is through fair government,
right,
who punishes evil.
And one of the things that that you touched on there, and this came up in our small group time as well yesterday, and that kind of occurred to me, was how often we hold our natural reaction, our natural response as right until proven wrong. Like we kind of default that because this is my natural reaction, it must be justified. Whereas often, that's not the case. It's actually the opposite. Is that when we read about the fact that we are sinful by nature, that our actual nature is corrupt within us, so that our natural reaction should be always second guess, third guess, fourth guess.
Well, we take them as justifications. Like, I know sometimes if someone says something cruel or
totally natural,
just something like, and my feelings are justified because of what has been said to me. I take that my feelings are justified, therefore a sharp-tongued response from me in response is justified because my feelings were justified, right?
My natural reaction if somebody wants to take a swing at me is to take a swing back at them. But it's sinful. Like, it's a sinful response. But here's the paradigm I wanted to ask you building off this question. Is like, what about, like, take Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So, concentration camp, Nazi Germany, under kind of Nazi rule, was a pastor, Christian. Like, he's kind of on the Mount Rushmore of, like, modern day, kind of last century Christian leaders, I would say. Like, he's up there. Martin Luther King would be up there. Bonhoeffer was a part of a group looking to assassinate Hitler. So, is that...
But he was just a man, so was it a sinful moment in that?
So he's just a man. I'm not saying throw all that out, he didn't do it. I'm saying, like, my natural reaction about Bonhoeffer is it had to be justified. Because he's a godly man.
You can read his biography, you can read about him. There's an excellent biography by Eric Metaxas. But, I mean, I'd say he personally felt a lot of upheaval in his soul about it. And he felt like he was stuck in a moral dilemma. So it was not something he took lightly. He felt that to do nothing, because he had unique, the thing that he had, as a world, he was becoming a world-renowned theologian. So he was actually traveling to the States, even during the early days of the war. He had access in and out of Nazi Germany when no one else did. And he was a delegate in theological conferences and stuff like that. And
I never knew that.
And so that was his job in the plot, in the July 6th plot, was it the name of it? Was to get information out, in and out. He carried messages. So, but he felt torn that to do nothing was morally wrong, and to participate in a plot to kill someone was morally wrong. And he felt deep turmoil in his soul over what he should do.
I wonder if God spared him in the end, because it's not what happened.
In the end, he decided that it was a greater wrong to do nothing.
Yeah.
So he did participate, but it wasn't something he took lightly. I think back to the question of, like, what about corrupt government and how do we seek justice without vengeance? Mm-hmm. I think that's where nonviolence comes in.
Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X.
Yeah. So...
Because, I have to be careful how I say that, because obviously I'm not African American. Yeah. So, but please, if you are and you're listening to this, don't take that as like.
If your skin is black, wouldn't you actually be African Canadian?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, moving on.
just trying to clarify. I think it's okay to say black.
In that way, you are submissive to government,
right?
And you're seeking justice. So you're not taking vengeance. You're obeying all those commands. Submit to the government authorities. Don't seek vengeance, but you're also promoting what is good, right, and holy, and exposing what is evil through your words and through nonviolence. And I think Martin Luther King and that whole movement that he was kind of figurehead of were able to hold that balance well.
Well, it held them above reproach.
Yeah.
Right?
So they were able to garner attention, expose evil without committing evil.
Right.
So there's a way, and I think that's the way forward in these things is, so through our words... drawing attention to things and exposing that which is evil, but without taking it on yourself. That's not his role to take. When they suffered, when they were beaten, when people were killed, they didn't take vengeance in that movement. Instead, by drawing attention to the plight and the wrong that was done, other people and the government stepped in and corrected things in time. But the reason why they actually survived, they accomplished more because they didn't take vengeance.
Exactly.
The reason why the whole movement was actually successful in the ways that it was is because things like Selma, what the movie was talking about, because they were mercilessly beaten and everyone saw it and was outraged and attention was drawn to the crime, that pressure was put on government. And so they did it while submissive to government. They didn't break the rules. and they didn't take vengeance, and they were able to accomplish way more. And I think that's actually the unfortunate thing about the Ferguson movement, is I think they have very good cause to object to what's happened, where policemen, I believe, in my ignorant, you know, I don't have all the information. From my perspective, it seems like there has been a unfortunate trend of overreacting and people being killed who have should not be killed, right? And it was, there's lots of complex things that are happening. But so I think there's good reason to object and to draw attention to that. But the way to do it is nonviolence, protest, not rioting.
Well, and vengeance,
because that's hurting the cause more than helping
it. And what they do, and what in these cases often is done, is that there's two extreme sides put. There's going to be the anti-police side that's going to say, don't trust police officers, react negatively, don't listen to them, reject authority. And there's going to be the other side that's the pro-police, say, for example, that every decision that a policeman makes is right and justified, and let's dehumanize the person that lost their life. Yeah. And the reality is like, it's too extreme trying to win an argument and trying to pull people to one side, and often we find the truth is down the middle a little more, where the reality is, you know, were the police people maybe culpable? Were the victims maybe culpable in some degrees? Could they have changed things had they behaved differently? But you're not going to be able to take revenge until there's a clear winner and a loser.
I think the only way that you can do nonviolent protests, submit to a less than morally upright government, any sort of level of corruption. You think about Paul wrote this to the Christians in Rome.
Right.
While the emperor is killing them. Like, he didn't say submit to government. Well, they were Republican, so that works. But Democrats, you don't have to. Yeah. Like, he's talking about Caesar when he writes this. So you can still submit to a corrupt, broken government, honor them as they're due, and yet point out injustice and draw attention to it while showing kindness to your enemies, but still pointing out their evil. And all of that is only possible because God is sovereign. You can trust, I can be wronged and I don't have to take vengeance because God will. I mean, I think of, The only way I think of, you know, Pastor Paul Johnson here at South Delta Baptist Church, and he wrote a great article on the website that I run, groundinthegospel.com, talking about forgiving the man who was accused of, I think he's still being tried, of murdering his son, and meeting with him, extending forgiveness to him, and sharing the gospel with him, praying for him. That is only possible because Paul believes deeply that God is sovereign. It's not his role to take vengeance on this young man. It's not his position. He can forgive because God is sovereign. Mm. And if God was not sovereign, he would feel compelled he had to take it into his own hands. Now, there's also a justice system that's doing its role.
Yeah.
So that plays a role too. But Paul has left it to the authorities and to God. So what's his role? Forgiveness.
Right.
And an opportunity to show grace.
And you know what? And in no greater, is there really no greater way that we actually die to ourselves and our desires than when we forgive unjustifiably. Like when we forgive someone who has clearly wronged us, who doesn't deserve us, because I actually think we, in doing so, preach the gospel to ourselves, and that we see our own unforgivable nature in front of a holy God, and should actually drive us to a deeper desire, level of repentance, whatever, like obedience to Jesus, because we're mirroring it, and I think God delights in
it. You think of the parable of the unforgiving servant. We who have been forgiven such a great debt as our own sin are called to pass that forgiveness on to others who owe us a smaller, much, much smaller.
Well, we have extended our time, so right now we are going to I can't do it without laughing. We're going to wrap things up. But if you have questions, as always, send them to the right email address, regardless of what I tell you on the B-side. But it is bside@tawassonalliance.org, because we're an organization. I always mess up the website. There's an email address I can never remember. B-side.
.gov.
No, I can't be right. .bc.ca.gov.tel us. But thank you for checking us. Thanks, Rhoda, for for joining us, and we will hope to hear that you will hear from us next week. But please, if you have any questions about what we talk about on the B-side today, or things going on in your life, or things you hear in the sermon, send them to the website, and we will look at them right now.